tonight, some of you might have noticed I'll be speaking about right speech, so I'll be talking about talking tonight. That's the theme. And maybe, like me, you've noticed what a tricky arena communication is. Don't you think? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is challenging. And speech is powerful. It really has this ability to heal us, to support us, and to awaken us. But it also has the power to harm and hurt, right? It's really this double-edged sword. And there's so many examples of that, just, you know, in terms of this country, in terms of the spoken word and also the written word. Just think about how powerful the Declaration of Independence was. Those written words were tremendously powerful. Or some words like a speech, like Martin Luther King's speech of "I have a dream." Those words had a tremendous amount of power on this country. But it's not only on that level, it's also on the personal level, right? I think all of us, you know, like me, I'm sure you've noticed how, you know, sometimes just the right words can really change things for us. You know, I've really noticed this with a number of teachers that I've studied with, just in terms of the Buddhist tradition. And how sometimes just a sentence can really transform my spiritual practice. It's really quite remarkable. And you might also have a sense, you know, of that experience. Or you might have a sense of how you have been able to say something brief that has really made the difference in someone else's lives. And oppositely, I think we know the other side too, how the words of someone else have been so hurtful, so harmful. And the experience of when you said something. Do you know when you said something and it's that feeling, oops, and you really hurt somebody? There's a tremendous power in our speech. So skillful speech, it can create the conditions for our well-being and the well-being of others. And as I was saying, it can create the conditions for harming and hurt. And it's not only on the personal level, but even in the political arena. I don't know if any of you saw this, but about a week and a half ago, Bill Clinton had written in the New York Times, and it was in commemoration of the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. And I want to share with you some of his letter. I think it was in the op-ed section. Because I think he's really speaking to this topic of right speech. And especially at this time, you know, in our lives or in this political atmosphere. So this is just a part of what he says. Let me share this with you. He says, "Criticism is part of the lifeblood of democracy. No one is right all the time. But we should remember that there is a big difference between criticizing a policy or a politician and demonizing the government that guarantees our freedoms and the public service servants who enforce our laws. We are again dealing with difficulties in a contentious, partisan time. We are more connected than ever before, more able to spread our ideas and beliefs, our anger and our fears. As we exercise the right to advocate our views and as we animate our supporters, we must all assume responsibility for our words and actions before they enter a vast echo chamber and reach those both serious and delirious, connected and unhinged." Do you hear what he's trying to point out here? As he's really pointed out, there's a place for criticism in democracy. And also, the way we voice that can really be creating harm rather than helping something. And I want to make sure that I think the striking thing about this, and unfortunately, you know, being Bill Clinton, he's going to be categorized as one side of this all the partisan politics, but he's really trying to speak more broadly than that. And there's this wonderful phrase that he has in this, which really strikes me, and that's taking responsibility before we speak, before it enters this vast echo chamber. Really great phrase. So when we speak, it's not only about how it affects me and you, but it goes beyond that. So this is what we want to begin to consider. How are the words that we're using, how is the mode of communication that we're using, how is it, what's its effect in this echo chamber? What are the intentions that we have behind those things that we're putting into that echo chamber? You know, and my intention here is not to make, you know, this realm of communication any simpler or less challenging. I mean, it's very challenging. But rather, it's to share some reflections that I hope will refine all of our skills in learning how to communicate. Because it is a challenging arena. So just a few things about right speech in terms of this path. Right speech is one of the factors in the Noble Eightfold Path. And it's part of, you could say, the part of the Eightfold Path which is really concerned about ethical conduct. And one of the things about engaging in ethical conduct on this spiritual path is that when we really have skill in our ethical conduct, for example, in speech, you know, when we're speaking skillfully, one of the things that comes with that is less regret. When there's less regret, the mind can really settle. It can calm and settle. And then when the mind is calm and settled, it can start to see clearly the way things are. And then when the mind starts to see the way things are, it begins to wake up. So in that sense, right speech is this vehicle, or it really supports, is the foundation for the mind waking up, for the heart becoming free. But that's only one aspect of right speech. I think there's another aspect of right speech. Not only does it lead to awakening and lead us to wisdom, but it's the embodiment of wisdom and awakening. So it's how we carry this practice forward into the world. It's how we manifest this practice. It was interesting, when Buddhism entered into China, they actually started to use, of course, different words, but words that have different nuances for these ideas of wisdom and awakening. Wisdom and awakening in early Buddhism was really associated with the seeing clearly. For example, vipassana means to see clearly. And when we meditate, that's what we begin to do, is we begin to clarify, or the mind starts to sharpen so it can see things clearly. It was really interesting when Buddhism entered into China, wisdom and awakening was much more about conduct. It was about how you embodied the practice, how you lived your life. So there was still, you know, this aspect of seeing clearly, but there was something more to it. There's a scholar by the name of Peter Hirschhoff, and he really describes this so accurately, I find. He says, it's not enough to see what Buddha nature is. Or in other words, it's not enough to see the fundamental nature of reality. You have to see what Buddha nature does. So it's not only seeing clarity, how do we embody that? How do we move forward? And so that's the other question for tonight. How do we really embody our practice through our speech? And I find this to be so important. Because, a lot of times there's this emphasis on meditation, but me sitting on the cushion isn't going to fulfill all the things I need to learn how to speak to another person. It just ain't going to happen. It's a different realm. It's not happening in the interpersonal realm. And of course, sitting is very important because it can really inform speech, but that ain't the whole path. It's very important to remember that. I know that After I left the Zen monastic thing, doing the Zen monastery thing, when I came out, what I realized is, you know, we are doing so much sitting there and so much meditation. I really could sit with anything that was arising in my internal experience. There was this real ability for that. I was so bad at communicating. I was quite the interpersonal dunce. That was something they weren't teaching us at the monastery. Right? So right speech is really important because it helps fill out the practice. So we need this. It's not just about sitting on a cushion. And that's important, right? That's really going to inform it. And tonight, what I'd like to actually talk about, this is going to be the first part in a two-part series. So I'd like to take a look at right speech by looking at a mode of communication that we usually don't put in this arena. And that's the use of silence. How do we use silence? You know, silence is just like speech in the sense that it can be just as powerful. Silence can lead us or can help in terms of healing. It can support us and it can lead to awakening. But it also can be very harmful and hurtful. You know, so tonight it really is this question, how do we use silence? How do you use silence in your life? What are you communicating with the silence that you use? And to examine these ways that we use silence that is rather unskillful and habitual. And also silence that has a skill to it and how to refine that. And one of the kind of the ideas that I'd like you to have in the background as I'm speaking about this is a guideline that the Buddha gave us in terms of right speech. Because I think it actually also applies to silence. It gives these five marks that we can look at in our speech to determine if it's skillful or not. And so this is what he says. He says, if speech has five marks, practitioners, it is well spoken, not badly spoken, blameless, and above reproach by the wise. What are these five marks? It is speech that is timely, true, gentle, purposeful, and spoken with a mind of loving kindness. So those five things. I usually boil it down to four so I don't have as big of a list to remember. I like small lists. So I usually really consider, is it true? Is it kind? Is it timely? And is it useful? And to consider that. It's a wonderful way to engage in refining our skill in speech. And it's also great guidelines in refining our skill in using silence. So I want to go over some of the ways that we can skillfully use silence and the unskillful ways that we use it. I mean, for me, I think it really is true. One of the best allies in right speech for me has been keeping my mouth shut at times. It's saved me a lot of grief and a lot of regret. And when I think about some of those times of really keeping my mouth shut or keeping silence, it was really the truest thing that I could offer. It was definitely the kindest thing. Because if you reflect on those times when you kept silent, a lot of times the things that wanted to pop out were very harmful. And useful. Have you ever noticed that feeling where you know the thing that wants to pop out is not so, so skillful, but it has kind of this momentum to it? Have you ever noticed that? Mm-hmm. So it's really useful to keep silent because there's that momentum that we're working against. We know it, but we really want to say it too. So it's very useful in that way. And timely, since that urge is coming up right then. It's very difficult. I think this is a real challenge of using silence as a way of restraint. Benjamin Rush, who was one of our, one of the founding fathers, helped with the Declaration of Independence, called it a rascally virtue, which I think is very apt. There's something slippery about it. One example of that is just from my own life, where I've seen keeping silent or really restraining from talking about certain things has really allowed things to unfold. For example, a couple of years ago, I went with my girlfriend and we visited her family in Texas. And so I met one of her brothers-in-law, and we had some different political views. He actually worked for Dick Cheney. So it was a little bit different. Yeah, he was on the inside circle. He was doing that kind of stuff. So, So there was a lot to keep silent about. In that circumstance, I knew that it was the most useful thing, because I knew that both of us weren't going to change our ideas or our views about politics. It was a moot point to really explore a lot of these ideas. It just didn't make sense. And it would have been oppositional in that way. But it was amazing to really practice this silence, because what started to emerge out of this is that we were able to connect on other things. And it was really what I felt really happened was there's this warmth in the connection that really was able to emerge from that, from my willingness to remain silent. It's something that I value. He's a wonderful guy to hang out with, but that wouldn't have happened if I didn't engage in that silence. So this silence can be really powerful in that sense. It can allow connections to happen where we don't think connections are possible. Also, please remember, at the same time, though, there's nothing holy about being silent. This is very important. There's nothing holy about being silent. Just because we remain silent doesn't mean it's true. It doesn't mean it's kind. And it doesn't mean it's timely or useful. Now, there's a number of ways that silence can be harmful, and I want to explore that with you, both on the individual and the collective level. And this is extremely important, because we can follow this edict: if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. And very interestingly, the Buddha wasn't saying that. And I want to make sure that there's a difference between kindness and nice. Sometimes when we say something that's kind or silent in a kind way, it still might disrupt things. Nice, to me, is this word that means that we don't want to disrupt anything. I don't think that's what kindness is about. Many times it can really settle things down, but not always. Yeah. But I think it can be very useful to have this guideline. Is it true? Is it kind? Is it timely? Is it useful? So on the individual level, I want to talk about this on the individual level, and maybe some of you can relate to this. There can be this quality of an angry silence or a passive-aggressive silence, right? It's that those times when you use silence as a way of withholding communication. And we use it as a way of sometimes being harmful or hurtful. Somebody wants to communicate with us, and we're withholding that opportunity to communicate. Right? We shut down. What's the intention behind that? It might sound like the silence of restraint, of skillful restraint, but it ain't, because the intention is to harm. You ever notice that? Engage in that? You know, there also could be, you could say, a fearful silence, or the silence of avoidance, where you might not want to talk because you're really avoiding something that's going on inside. You don't want to communicate what's going on inside or share what's going on inside. So it's this silence of avoidance. So the intention, again, is avoiding what's going on inside. Again, it might sound like this skillful silence, but what's the intention? It doesn't seem very true or kind or timely a lot of times. And what that flows into is that sometimes, you know, if we find ourselves never sharing any of our thoughts and feelings, then there's probably something that's gone amiss about our silence. Of course, there's many times where we don't want to share some of the thoughts, many of the thoughts that arise in our heads or the feelings. That can be very skillful. But other times, it's just a way of disconnecting rather than connecting, as a way of avoiding another person or what's going on inside. Maybe some of you can relate to this. Have you ever noticed these qualities of silence in your life? Right? Yeah. And sometimes when we're engaging in these kinds of silence, it could be that we're taking on the guise of trying to look holy, this appearance of looking holy. But that's not the intention. So we need to really look at the intention behind our silences. And then not only on the individual level does this happen, but on the collective level. And I want to share with you actually a famous quote that some of you might have heard before. It's by a pastor, Martin Niemöller, who lived during World War II in Germany. And just a little history about him. Before he kind of put these words down, he actually supported the Nazis and then started to change his perspective and speak out against them. And this is one of the things he said. He said, "First they came for the communists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me." And it's interesting, you know, after he spoke out, he did spend 7 years in concentration camps in Dachau and Sachsenhausen. And it was interesting, even at after coming out of the concentration camps, his biggest regret was not saying something sooner. His regret was not saying something and going to the concentration camps. It was more not saying something soon enough, which I find striking. So we've seen how disastrous silence can be. But I think it's not only in these extreme situations that silence can be harmful. It can be harmful on more subtle levels. You know, as they say, in terms of relationships, the dynamics in relationships or in family dynamics, is that what is not spoken about is many times more powerful than what is spoken about. So it's the things that families don't speak about, or relationships or people in relationships don't speak about, that can be quite disastrous, or at least unhealthy. I mean, just think about the things that weren't spoken about in your family, or the things that weren't spoken about in relationships that you know. And sometimes we can see on how unhealthy that is. You know, a common one many times in this culture, and even in Buddhist culture, is, for example, the topic of sex and sexuality. Now, how can you cultivate a healthy or a liberating relationship to sex or sexuality if you're not talking about it? It's kind of difficult. It doesn't help. That kind of silence doesn't help. I remember a family, and this was a white American family, which is important because there can be different cultural contexts for this type of behavior. But this family, they had a son who had been killed in a climbing accident when the son was about 19 years old. And the father of the family insisted that the family never mention the son's name again. And when friends came over and said something about the son, even mentioned his name, he insisted that they didn't say his name or even talk about him. That's a disastrous kind of silence. No space for any kind of grieving. Really, that another way that silence can be harmful is that sometimes silence can be the dynamic of abuse. Right? It can perpetuate abuse. Just in terms of sometimes the abuses that happen in communities or families, it's the silence that allows it to continue. And of course, with those kind of situations, it can be dangerous to speak up, but it's the silence that's really perpetuating it. I remember when I was at the Zen Center, one of the things that was arising, and unfortunately was arising for too many years and for too long, is that the Zen master I practiced underneath was engaging in this sexual misconduct, which was extremely harmful. And so a number of us monks had gotten together and decided to write this letter of expressing concern. And I think the main reason we wanted to do it was because there was this veil of silence that was so destructive. And then, of course, what happened is everybody tried to clamp it down and not say anything about it. And it was an issue then, of course, that was put under the table again, as best as possible. So it can be dangerous. Sometimes people don't want to speak out because it can really rock the boat. Such an important thing. I realized it was so important for us to speak out and to continue to talk about it, because I was noticing that my silence was actually a part of the dynamic. It was kind of shocking to think that, oh, actually, me being silent, I am actually supporting harm. So again, there's nothing holy about silence. And also, silence doesn't let us off the hook in terms of non-harming. Or in terms of harming, right? Just because we're silent doesn't mean that we're not harming. Do you see that in the example that I just gave? That me being silent actually perpetuated the harm. So we need to see the intentions behind our silence so that we're engaging in it skillfully. So that we can really support this intention of non-harming. One of the things I'll speak about next week, but just a small caveat. And also we have to remember when we speak out to have these guidelines of, is it true, is it kind, is it useful, and is it timely? There's many ways where we can think we're breaking the silence, but in a harmful way. But I'll speak about that more next week as well. Silence, on the flip side, can also be very healing and supportive. It's amazing, and I'm sure all of you have noticed what amazing a gift it can be to offer silence. Rather than filling up each moment with some word, what is it like to really offer silence into communication or into a relationship with another person? It can really provide the space for others to speak, to reflect, to settle. I know in our study group in Flagstaff, I heard that this is what you all did in your study group here, but what we made sure to do is towards the end of each study group is to really allow a space for those who haven't spoken. And the neat thing about that is that it allowed our group to really hear from everyone. But not only that, it really allowed people to not have to have this pressure of really going against maybe the flow of all the speaking to really get their voice heard. So is this intention that we had as a group to allow space, to allow silence, to really hear from everyone? Silence can also be a powerful statement. I don't know if anyone here has practiced with Sayadaw Ubivekananda. I think he came a couple times. Marcia Rose sponsored him to come to New Mexico a couple times. But he has a monastery in Nepal, and it was very fascinating to watch him sometimes in conversations, especially if he was surrounded by a conversation that was extremely inappropriate that was going on, and he would be kind of in the midst of it. His silence would speak volumes. It really was. There was just some way that he would engage in silence around certain conversations that you really got a clear message about his feeling about it, or that was very skillful. It was really quite striking, the kind of the power of that silence and the way he skillfully was able to engage in it. So it's important to remember that also silence can really have a power to it. The last thing I want to speak to you about, though, is that silence also can be very liberating. You know it's within our deepest silences that wisdom and liberation begin to emerge. And I'm sure many of you who've been on retreats, or many of you just in your meditation, have noticed how silence really supports a seeing clearly, or for wisdom to arise in our lives. Have you noticed that? The power of, for example, of noble silence on a retreat. Or maybe just the silence here when you come and sit. It can really have this liberating effect to it. So it's at the basis of our meditation practice and of the spiritual path. And I want to give you an example of this. Actually, I want to speak about this a little bit more, but I want to speak about it in terms of a Buddhist story. And it's really the story that you find in this sutra. It's called the Vimalakirti Sutra. And it's a sutra that is very significant. Of course, it's from the Mahayana tradition, but it's a very significant text for the Mahayana tradition. And the main character in the sutra is this man by the name of Vimalakirti. And Vimalakirti is a businessman. And it's said that the depth of his insight, or the depth of his awakening, was equal to the Buddha's. So really this deep insight that he had, this deep awakening. And this story, might not be a factual story, but it's a true story. There's a lot of truth in it. And the setting of the story takes place in Vimalakirti's room, in his bedroom, because he's sick. And it's said in the sutra that he's sick because... And it's not because of any physical ailment. It's because all beings are sick. He is sick because all beings are sick, because he's this bodhisattva that has this intention to liberate all beings. But there's a difference between Vimalakirti's sickness and the sickness that all beings have. Because he has a sickness that he's using to liberate all beings, that brings beings to liberation. So he has a skill in using sickness as an embodiment or as a path to awakening. A sickness that helps us go beyond sickness. So that's the setting of the story. Here, Vimalakirti is sick in his bedroom. And the way it takes place at the beginning is the Buddha is asking his monastics to go visit Vimalakirti. He's sick. He's sick in his bedroom. Can you please go visit him? And so the Buddha asks, one monastic, and one monastic says, I'm not going to go see Vimalakirti. The last time I saw him, he raked me over the coals. I couldn't believe it. I thought I had all this depth in the Dharma, and then I go to Vimalakirti and he shows me I really don't. So then the Buddha asks another monastic and he gets the same answer. He goes through all the monastics. Nobody wants to go visit Vimalakirti. And he asks all these bodhisattvas and the same thing. And then finally, they get a retinue of bodhisattvas led by Manjushri to go visit Vimalakirti. Luckily, Manjushri has some courage to go visit Vimalakirti. So they go and visit Vimalakirti, and of course they start chatting about this and that, about the Dharma, of course. And they start to explore together this one question. And the question is, what is a bodhisattva's entry, or what is a practitioner's entry into the Dharma gate of non-duality? So basically the question is what's the gateway for a practitioner to the fundamental nature of reality? How does the practitioner see the fundamental nature of reality? What's the gateway to there? And all the bodhisattvas go and give their answers, and Manjushri gives his answer. And the kind of the pinnacle of this story is that when Manjushri asks Vimalakirti, you know, what is a bodhisattva's entry into the Dharma gate of non-duality? Vimalakirti is silent. And it's known as Vimalakirti's thunderous silence. And why is that? Because it just wasn't any silence like the silences that I've been talking about. It was the silence that embodied that very gate, that very gateway to the fundamental nature of reality. And it was an expression of that. So I don't know if you can imagine that kind of power in a silence. A thunderous power to it. I think our practice here is to get a taste of that silence. And not only to get a taste of it, but as I was saying, to embody that. So I want to share with you what are the ingredients in Vimalakirti's thunderous silence, so that we can get a sense of, you know, how we can get a taste of it, how we can embody this. So I want to share with you what I'd call some of the ingredients of it, because once we get some of the ingredients of this silence, then we'll get more of a fuller taste of it, because the ingredients are so important. Right? Ingredients are important in a meal. For example, this last winter, my girlfriend and I, we made chocolate truffles for gifts. We made raw truffles, so it was all raw ingredients. And it was the ingredients that made them so tasty. So what are the ingredients in this silence? So I want to share with you some images that are in the sutra that give us a feeling for the quality of Vimalakirti's silence. One was in the sutra, in the story, there's a situation where the gods, the deities, are raining flowers down this whole retinue of people around Vimalakirti. And it's said that these beautiful flowers, they all stick. They're sticking to the monastics. The flowers are sticking to them. They're trying to get them off, but they can't. They're sticking. It's horrible. They're getting all over the robes and everything. But for Vimalakirti, the flowers don't stick. Things don't stick to Vimalakirti. Things arise and pass away, but they're not going to stick. So they can shower down, and there's no sticky quality to Vimalakirti's mind or his body. Right? So it's this non-stickiness, it's that quality of silence, where things don't get entangled up with us, or we don't get entangled up with them. There can be the beauty of the flowers, but they move the way they should. So that's one quality. Another image that's very striking in this story is that when the bodhisattvas come to Vimalakirti, it's said that 35,000 bodhisattvas come to see Vimalakirti. And they all get into his room and there's still space left. That's what they say. And not only is there space left, but there's big lion thrones for each one of them. So how can he hold so many people in his room? It's because he's emptied his room. Right? Because it's empty. It's spacious. That when we enter, when we empty the space that we inhabit, what do we have? We have the space for whatever to arise, to allow it to arise. We have the space for any person that comes into our space. We have space for that. We don't have it crowded with all our junk and our furniture that we carry around in our minds. I mean, it's amazing the things that we fill up our space with. But Vimalakirti wasn't doing this. There was this vast space there. Have you ever noticed that you have a mind that has a room for this person but not that person? Or it has space for this situation but not that situation? Or it has room for this emotion but not that emotion? Have you ever noticed that? That's not Vimalakirti's room. His room has space for all beings, right? 35,000 of them. That's rather striking. So his silence has the flavor of that, of a room like that, that has space for whatever arises, for whatever being he comes face to face with. You know, giving space for others in which we're not confining them or judging them. Rather providing them space. The other thing I want to point out about this is they're in his room. It's not like he is in his room and they're outside of his room. They're in the same space together. So it's not the situation that they are out there and we are in here. It's not a situation of us and them. They're abiding together in one room. Have you noticed how we have a mind that divides between us and them, me and you? In a way that's really more about disconnection rather than connecting. So another quality of Vimalakirti's silence. Do you hear the sense of freedom in such a room? Can you imagine what it would be like to be able to provide, metaphorically, that kind of room for every person that you meet? Or every situation that you meet? Or every emotion that arises? Could we provide that kind of room, and to provide also a lion throne for each kind of situation or emotion that arises? Or person? So this is the quality of silence that we want to begin to see and to embody. So may our practice together lead to such a silence. Thank you.